Hi, this is Barry List at Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science at Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. How well do business leaders understand the value of information technology and analytics? In today's segment, we speak with Michael Schrage, a research fellow at the MIT Center for Digital Business. He's also a visiting fellow at the Imperial College Business School's Innovation and Entrepreneurship Program in London. Michael has focused recently on value creation in IT and analytics. He'll speak at the Informs Conference, Applying Science to the Art of Business, which takes place in Orlando, Florida from April 18 to 20th. Michael, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you.
In a recent interview with the MIT Sloan Management Review, you said that IT gets a bum rap. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think IT gets a bum rap for two separate and distinct reasons. Number one, there's the view that information technology is a necessary evil, and it's overhead, and it's infrastructure, and it's something that you have to invest in rather than a source of differentiation and value creation. The other is simply that it's technology. It's geekified. It's quant-oriented. It's something that is not core to the business. And these two pathological views, I think, undermine how general managers and C-suite people really perceive and invest in technology as a source of value creation rather than a source of business management. I think those things are different. I think there's a difference between using IT to keep the trains running on time and using IT as a vehicle to create aviation, to create rocket ships, to create new modes and genres of transport.
And approaching the way companies should look at IT, you've said that they're not starting with their goals and then making their purchase of IT. Why are they doing things backwards? You'd expect more.
I'm very sympathetic to a lot of these organizations, because almost immediately what you do when you see some new technology or you see technology out there and you're an organization, your immediate reaction sort of tends to be, gee, what are other people doing with it? So you sort of have a default to benchmark approach. It's like, what's the crowd doing? What are people like me doing? So they sort of begin with, and this is this is reasonable and rational. They sort of begin with, okay, this is interesting. Who else is doing interesting stuff with this? And I think a healthier benchmarking, yeah. And I think a healthier reaction is, okay, these technologies create a capacity and a capability that might make a difference. Who are we as an organization? What are we trying to do as an organization? No, really, what are we really trying to do as an organization? And when we look at our strategic intent, when we look at the customers who we have and who we want to have, how can we use these technologies to better align, to better enable what our strategic intent is? So my view is basically too many organizations default to benchmarking rather than look at their core strategic desires and intent and say, if this is what we really want to accomplish as an organization, how can these new media, how can these new technologies aid us?
Along those lines, you make a point that IT is not a commodity like coal or gas, and then anyone who thinks that IT is a commodity should get out of the business world, which seems a little bit on the harsh side. Why did you feel so strongly about that?
No, I don't think it's on the harsh side. I think if you're that foolish to view technology as a commodity, then I'm not going to trust you with my money, and you shouldn't be trusted with investors' money. And to make an analogy that brings it closer to the OR world, to the operations research world, you know, the ability to do analytics is a commodity, right? The equations are there for everyone to see. But if you tell me that businesses should say, oh, well, analytics are a commodity, what's the big deal? We're not going to use analytics. How can you really differentiate yourselves with analytics? It's just a commodity. It's just a bunch of numbers. Everybody has access to those equations, just like everybody has access to an IT network or everybody has access to Google. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's nonsense on stilts. The idea that information technology and digital media are commodities is as foolish as thinking that cutting-edge analytics or simplex algorithms are commodities. They're not commodities. They're enablers. They're enablers. And I think you are a bad business person, a foolish investor, if you think enablers are commodities and behave that way.
Now, you get into the whole idea of IT and value, and you quote Warren Buffett, who once said, price is what you pay, value is what you get. How does that apply to IT and analytics?
Well, I think it's first off, you can't go wrong quoting Warren Buffett.
Not these days.
I think it applies quite directly, because I think there is, again, for completely understandable reasons, there's nothing wrong with looking at the price tag. You know, I think it makes sense to look how much things cost. But we have to keep in mind that there are two kinds of costs. There's the kind of cost that you pay in the source of price, in terms of price, and then there's the kind of cost associated with, okay, we bought this thing, or this technique, or this service, how do we use it? And that incurs costs, training, education, implementation, application, making sure people understand how to get value out of something. And so that's why that Buffett insight is so important, because it is we really need to have the courage and the discipline and the rigor to say, okay, here's the price cost, here's the organizational cost, but how does it align with the value that we're going to get from making this kind of investment? So yes, I care enormously about the return. And there are times when spending a lot of money and a lot of time is tremendously worth it, because the returns can be disproportionately great. And by the way, this is what I think is so cool about information technology and, yes, the analytic infrastructures that people in the OR community proffer. We are benefits of an exponential economic revolution. The cost of digital media, the cost of IT is going down.
The whole Moore's Law thing fits in with this to an extent.
Exactly. Moore's Law, Metcalfe's Law, and as the costs of computational and networking infrastructures go down, the cost of running sophisticated and high-powered analytics over those infrastructures go down as well. So you have, your industry, your business has a virtuous cycle going on. Better analytics, lower costs. Lower cost of digital computation, that sort of creates a giant sucking sound so we can suck in more analytic techniques and exploration and simulation and computation to create new ways to create new value.
You've said that IT is not information management but people management. How so?
Well, you know, I've written on this topic decades ago. I think, unfortunately for IT, it's a victim of a bad brand. That, you know, people think that information technology, that these technologies are about managing information or about managing data. And I think that's a bunch of rubbish. I think it's completely a bunch of rubbish, because what I think these technologies are really about are managing relationships. I think that what things like Facebook and Google do is not just allow us to better manage information. It allows us to better manage interactions and relationships between people. You know, I think that we'd be better off, instead of having CIOs, chief information officers, we call them CROs, chief relationship officers. When we look at loyalty programs, when we talk about using databases to manage loyalty programs, what we're really talking about is how do we use information to manage interactions and relationships between people. Information is a means to an end. I think what these technologies should really be seen as are as media to manage interactions with people.
And not the medium as a message, which has often been a problem.
Exactly. I think that information may be the special sauce, but the reality is that value comes from managing interactions between people.
You had some interesting things to say in this interview about how you speak with CEOs and CIOs and CROs about what they're overlooking in IT and analytics. How do you approach it with them? What do you tell them?
Well, you know, I really don't tell them anything. I really spend most of my time asking them questions and listening very closely to the answers. I mean, I pretty much begin by asking, well, what are you really trying to do? What are you really trying to do? Ordinarily, when they engage me, they're saying, you know, technology is important. How do we use technology more effectively? You know, they're saying, okay, we know that we have to use technology. Help us use technology better. And I just like your opening question, I think that's the wrong way to begin, even though it's an understandable way to begin. I begin with, what are you really trying to accomplish? How do you want your customers to describe an interaction with your salespeople, with your channel? How do you want them to describe the moments of truth, the moment of purchase, the moment of first use of the product? How do you want them to describe you to potential prospects for your products or services? And, you know, I listen to these things, we prioritize them, we rank them, and then we try to get down to the essence, which is, okay, so this is how you really want to differentiate yourself. This is really the arc of transformation that you're on as an organization and as an innovator, right? And they say, yes, this is what we're really trying to do. I think this is critical for us to succeed over the next 3 to 5 years. And the moment I hear them say, this is what's critical for us to succeed over the next 3 to 5 years, all of a sudden, that prioritizes the way we should be talking about technology as an enabler to achieve that. And I'll be blunt. 9 out of 10 times, it's not just the technology that's going to be key as an enabler. It's the analytics that you interact with the technology that enables that as well. So these things really are of a piece. But I believe you got to begin with what we're really trying to accomplish, not just what the technology apparently is capable of doing at this point in time and might be able to do next year.
One of your expressions of frustration about not understanding the value of IT was a variation on the current joke that if you want to figure out a new technology, ask your teenager. Remind us how you apply this to getting value out of IT.
Well, you know, some of my best friends are teenagers and half teenagers, but, you know, I think it is completely understandable why people in their 30s and their 40s and their 50s might be laggards in regards to how they explore and play with what technologies can do. My basic view is that if it becomes, and I'll pick on a company here, you know, you look at some of these giant ERP enterprise resource planning systems like from SAP and Oracle, and one of the real issues is they're very, very expensive to play with. Not only are they expensive to play with, they're not fun to play with. And I think one of the fascinating things about the Web 2.0 technologies is that they're both fun to play with and cheap to play with. And things that are fun to play with and cheap to play with, you can learn faster, you can learn better. And that's where we should be inspired, and I use that word loosely, by teenagers, because teenagers and kids, they're learning machines. They're genetically, organically programmed to learn, and they're genetically and organically programmed to play with stuff. And I think that's where there's a cue for people of an older generation, which is we have these tools, we have these techniques, we have these technologies. The costs associated with playing and learning from them is going down. That's a real opportunity for value differentiation and innovation creation.
Moving to an example, I remember when I went to the UK, I discovered the Tesco supermarkets, and you've held up Tesco as an example of a company using IT in a practical, smart way. What's going right at Tesco?
Well, I think Tesco, I'm glad you raised it. Tesco is a fascinating organization, and unlike a lot of organizations that are rich in human capital, when Tesco, which is a supermarketer, has to innovate, you know, they have to innovate with people who have dropped out of high school.
And that's a very important point that you key on that I'm sure many people might miss.
I appreciate your pointing that out. Yes, it's easier to have sophisticated innovation at a place like Harvard or MIT or Goldman Sachs than at supermarkets like Tesco and Walmart. But the reality is the Tescos and the Walmarts are very, very innovative. And the design heuristics for innovation at Tesco are threefold. The first is it has to be better for customers. I mean, big shock. How, you know, you have to be pretty stupid if you come up with an innovation that you can't in some form make a business case that it isn't better for your customers. The second heuristic they use, the second organizing principle, is cheaper for Tesco. Big shock, you know, but you have to have a business case that shows that you're not paying a premium for these things, that you're actually reducing, cutting costs. But the third one is the thing that knocks out over half of the proposed innovations of Tesco, and that is simpler for staff. You know, you can cheat better, you can cheat cheaper, but you can't cheat simpler. Your workforce won't let you. And I think this is, and I've gone into organizations and I've asked people that, you know, for show of hands, who in the room is in charge of simpler for staff? And the hands almost never go up in organizations. Every now and then somebody speaks up and says, oh, no, we don't have to worry about simpler for staff because we have good training. Well, guess what? Oftentimes the training people have an incentive in having things be more complicated or complex because they become more valuable under those circumstances.
And just to give an example from a different place, I walk into my local haircuttery, and every time I go there, the women at the cash register are trying to figure out how to do their data entry and how to pay for me and my kids. And that plays in with what you're saying. Design it for the people who need to use it.
Absolutely. And this whole notion of how do you make things simpler and more accessible, but preserving the richness and depth of the underlying idea, that is an enormous challenge. We want to make sure that we talk about costs and everything, the Warren Buffett line, complexity is a cost. And one of the most important things a sophisticated, smart business person does is look at what are the meaningful, constructive ways to make things simpler. That's a real challenge both in the technology interface design world, but also in the analytics world, because we can't count on everybody doing analytics to have a PhD in statistics from Stanford or MIT or Berkeley.
And unfortunately, there are people in analytics who have an unfortunate talent for making the complex complex.
I would say that that's what they get tenure for, making the complex complex. But I think you're pointing on a really key cultural issue here, which ties into the Informs conference. Because when you go to an academic conference in operations research or in statistics and probability, people revel in the subtlety and the nuance and complexity of the algorithms that they're using. But at an Informs conference, at a practice conference, the priority and the emphasis has to be different. And that emphasis has to be on what are the swiftest, simplest, most cost-effective ways to make these algorithms, to make these analytics relevant and usable and valuable to the organization. Simplicity is key in an implementation environment.
You've described your work as the behavioral economics of innovation. What do you mean by that?
Well, when we studied economics in school, the classic model of economics was of, you know, Homo economicus, the rational maximizer, how people are supposed to behave. That's the normative school. You know, here's how you're supposed to behave when given these sorts of choices among these sorts of prices and indifference curves, what have you. And, of course, what we've discovered in the real world is that how people are supposed to behave bears no known resemblance to how they actually behave.
Is this what like the what the economists call a freshwater-saltwater economist debate?
Actually, no. The freshwater-saltwater is the University of actually, it's ironic, because there's the University of Chicago and the MIT-Harvard axis. The Chicago area was more of free market laissez-faire, although the irony of your point is one of the pioneering behavioral economists, Richard Thaler, is in fact from the University of Chicago and a co-author of a wonderful book on the policy implications of behavioral economics, Nudge, a book that Thaler wrote with Cass Sunstein. Sunstein is now one of the regulatory czars in the current administration in the White House. But the essence of behavioral economics is how do we integrate what we know about how people actually behave in a psychological context, in a real-world choice context, with the so-called fiction of the rational maximizer. And you have Nobel Prize-winning work, Kahneman and Tversky, Daniel Kahneman, and to a lesser extent, Vern Smith's work in experimental economics, where it turns out that indeed how people actually behave in the real world oftentimes is a better predictor and a better explainer of economic choices and economic policy than what the Samuelsons and the Friedmans conceived, you know, 50 years ago in their freshwater, saltwater debates.
Dan Ariely, who's at Duke and I believe has an MIT connection, has been working in behavior.
He was my colleague at MIT. He was writing his book predictably irrational at MIT.
And I was wondering if there was a tie-in between what you were saying and his field of research.
His work has been an inspiration to my own, and in fact, he and I, for about a year, ran workshops together in how do we design simple behavioral economics experiments in businesses so that would both advance Dan's research, but would also give businesses insight into the actual behavioral economics as a source of experiments in behavioral economics as a source of analytics. And it's a very interesting.
Usually experiments are done at the academic level. Why are you telling companies to do experiments and keep it simple?
Because for a couple of reasons. You know, to be very blunt, if I had been advising organizations to do more experiments a decade ago, they would understandably kick me out of their office because they would look at me quite rightly and say, you know, it's cheaper for us to do data processing analysis than business experiments because experiments are expensive. You know, EXP, experiments are expensive. Full circle. Digital media, Web 2.0, the cost of doing experiments. You can do a global experiment on Facebook and on Google for not thousands of dollars, but hundreds of dollars. You can use things like SurveyMonkeys and do conjoint analysis, you know, for thousands of dollars. Stuff like that used to cost literally hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, so the economics of experimentation have been transformed. And I believe what we're going to see over the next 5 to 7 years is hopefully a happy marriage or an uneasy collaboration between top-down analytics and bottom-up experimentation. And the common battle space for this is going to be the digital media for computation and networking that the operations research community is cultivating through analytics and that the Web 2.0 community is cultivating through innovations in the web sphere.
We only have time for one more question, and I thought I would take you back about a dozen years. You talked to the National Research Council about communicating math to the public and the problems that mathematicians have expressing themselves to the public. Operations researchers work extensively with math, as we've been saying. Has anything changed since then?
Yes, things have gotten worse.
Uh-oh.
You know, it's funny because, of course, the OR community under the president, Richard Larson, a terrific guy at MIT, launched the whole Science of Better and the idea campaign. And the whole idea was, what are the stories we can tell, which I think is the exact right way to go because most people, most of the time, are interested in hearing a good story than learning a new equation.
Sure.
But we have seen a collapse of numeracy and literacy in the educational system, and this is rife from graduate education to university education to high school education. And what I argued for in the talk of the National Research Council is that we should just give up on numeracy in that regard. I think we need to have the counterpart of, for want of a better phrase, art appreciation courses. You know, physics for dummies, I think we need to have, not for dummies, what we need is a focus on how do we get people to appreciate, understand key principles, but not necessarily the technical details, how do we get people to understand and appreciate the quantitative underpinnings of models and simulations and operations research and in probability and in statistics.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Michael Schrag of the MIT Center for Digital Business. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our listeners can hear more from Michael at the Informs Practice Conference in Orlando in April. Thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.